This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 21st of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Rylan, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, I'll be bringing you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and The Monocle Daily. Coming up...
The positioning of the statue in front of Parliament is something that, in particular in India, people are really picking up on.
We hear the view from historian Richard Williams in a highlight from The Globalist. Also ahead...
There's rarely a hashtag campaign that kind of reaches, you know, the mainstream media for positive reasons.
A failed Starbucks campaign sparked a debate over what happens when adverts backfire in this highlight from The Briefing. Plus, a look at one of the episodes of our weekly series on looting and cultural destruction. All that and much, much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Ben Rylan. On Monday, we kicked off the week on The Globalist by having a look at the newest addition to London's Parliament Square, a statue of Mahatma Gandhi. It's 100 years since Mahatma Gandhi returned to India to begin the struggle for the country's independence from Great Britain. And in London last weekend, a statue of him was unveiled in Parliament Square, a stone's throw from the statue of a man who once called Gandhi a seditious Middle Temple lawyer, now posing as a fakir of a type well known in the East. Emma Nelson was joined by Richard Williams, a historian from King's College London.
It's quite an interesting case, really, and the positioning of the statue in front of Parliament is something that, in particular in India, people are really picking up on. And there's a lot of confusion about this, and you can see in all of the media, in Delhi in particular, people are confused about his proximity to Churchill, because, as you say, Churchill had this very staunch negative view of Gandhi, and... it's a bit confusing to have this juxtaposition. It isn't the first time Gandhi has had a statue in central London. He's there in Bloomsbury, along with Rabindranath Tagore. But there, it's the cultural centre, the university centre of the city. And so he's very much positioned as an intellectual, a philosopher, a humanitarian. But having him in public political space next to political leaders is a very different step. And so I think there's an element of confusion about precisely what he's doing there.
He has been placed, I think, a little bit lower than all the other people, you know, statues around the square to show that he was, in fact, a man of a people, as opposed to someone who's quite aloof, although Nelson Mandela's in there as well. I'm not quite sure what that's supposed to mean. But when unveiling the statue, the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, said, India and the UK share the same values and we are a partnership of equals. Really?
Well, again, this is something that's... sort of raised a few question marks and a bit of alarm everywhere. The main issue, I think, with this statue is asking precisely why it's been there, why it's been installed there, and what the new relationships are between Britain and India, and the rhetoric around this statue. I mean, there are many good reasons for putting Gandhi there, no question. But this idea of forming a new relationship politically is something that not everyone's particularly sure about. So, I mean, for example, if we were installing the statue as a gesture of recognition, saying that the balance of power between Britain and South Asia is very different now, then that would be one thing. If it's a recognition of colonial guilt, that would be another. But I think there's been a bit of alarm about the sort of political whitewashing going on about the relationship between India and Britain.
And also, when the statue, well, the announcement of the statue was made, it happened pretty much at the same time as the announcement of a £250 million deal to sell arms to India, which people immediately joined the two announcements together. But I mean, listening to Lord Desai, the man who made the statue happen, said that if it was coincidence, so be it. You know, if it's not coincidence, so be it. It's just important that this statue is here. Is he missing a point?
Well, I think he is. And certainly a lot of the criticism about this particular event and the timing is saying that we're raising up Gandhi literally onto a pedestal as a symbol of nonviolence, as a symbol of finding political progress through peaceful methods. And so to have this juxtaposition with deals relating to arms, relating to military interventions, etc., is a very awkward positioning. So I think again, whitewashing is sort of the key theme here.
That was Emma Nelson speaking to Richard Williams, a historian from King's College London, on Monday's edition of The Globalist. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Now we turn our attention to China and press freedom. A film about air pollution in China called Under the Dome has attracted hundreds of millions of viewers online. It was made by a newscaster for China's central television and has subsequently been blocked by government censors. On Tuesday's edition of Midori House, Tom Edwards was joined by Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue.
Actually, this is a very, very interesting case because it had phenomenal success very quickly. 200 million people watched it online. It was a sort of version of Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. It was the same kind of format. It wasn't revealing anything people didn't know. They lived this absolutely every day. You know, you have one child, you can't let it go out to play because the air is toxic. So you have to say, so why was it such a hit? Why was it such a success? The other interesting thing about it is that this was clearly not made against the government's, or at least parts of the government's, wishes. So then you have to look at what do we mean when we say the Chinese government? This is not, again, a monolithic institution. So you have the Ministry of Environmental Protection, which is a weak but reasonably honest ministry that has absolutely reached the limits of its power up against very powerful economic interests, against big state-owned enterprises, against other bits of government that would rather prioritize GDP growth. And so you have officials appearing in this film, talking on camera very, openly. The government then lets it run for, best part of 10 days, I think, in the approach to what's called the Lianghui, the two meetings. So the main one of which is the National People's Congress, big political set piece theatre. So it's as though that those who are really serious about cleaning up the environment were having a run at mobilizing public opinion and putting pressure on those meetings. And I would count amongst those probably the Prime Minister, Li Keqiang. But of course, its popularity, there is a point in this film where she urges citizens to take action. And I think the sheer scale of the popularity of this began to alarm them. And the thought that people would take to the streets, it was kind of uh-oh. So what we see is calibration. Yes, the film's been closed down. Nothing has happened to her. Nothing will happen to her. And you have ratcheted up concern several notches, which is good for people who are trying to clean up.
That was a highlight from last week's Midori House programme here on Monocle 24. Time now for a highlight from Tuesday's Monocle Daily. Angola, on the west coast of Africa, is an economic success story whose growing influence across the continent is built on lucrative exports, oil and diamonds. But it wasn't always that way. Angola emerged from a bloody civil war in 2002, and the nation's rebound has been assisted by outside influences from nations such as China and Portugal. Ricardo Suarez de Oliveira is an associate professor in comparative politics at the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of Oxford, and his new book, Magnificent and Beggarland Angola Since the Civil War, aims to capture a picture of the country today and where it might be headed. Monocle's Steve Bloomfield spoke with him. They started by talking about the cost of living in Luanda.
It is, in fact, the most expensive city in the world. Most of the time over the last 8 or 9 years, the cost of living survey has ranked Luanda as the most expensive city, higher than Oslo, higher than Tokyo, for about half of those years. So anything from a Big Mac to just riding on a taxi, if you can find one, to renting a flat, the basics of life are extraordinarily expensive.
What's striking about this book is that lots of people know that Angola is incredibly expensive to be in. They know that there is huge amounts of oil wealth, but actually, huge poverty amongst many of its population. But you point out here the sort of complicity of the West in quite stark terms.
Well, I think that it's important to put this into the context. Angola is not a story that happens in planet Mars. It's very much part of the world economy, even during the war years, during which Angola is very isolated in some ways. In other ways, the oil and the diamonds that Angola produced kept on circulating onto the world economy. That openness has only increased since 2002. And very much part of the economic story there is the involvement of service providers. You could use that as a euphemism. From banks to consultants to all sorts of foreigners who play a very important role in that economy for good and ill.
In terms of then the West's relationship with Angola, it's often been pointed out that Angola is now turning to China quite a lot. But do you see that as more as a way of keeping the West on its toes? Because it still wants, Angolans would far prefer a Western lifestyle than a Chinese lifestyle. They're going to London, not Shanghai.
I think that's right. I think that about 10, 15 years ago, the West was quite pushy on the human rights front. Not overly pushy.
No. but
it did raise the issues, especially states like Britain, the Scandinavian countries, Canada, the United States. And the coming of China in 2004 rather concentrated the minds of Western partners. They realized that in order to stay, to be part of this story, which is not just an oil story, but it's also the national reconstruction story, all the business opportunities that came up over the last decade, that they would have to press those rights issues far less. And in some cases, stop talking about them altogether. But the Angolan intention is very much to keep as many players on the table as possible. There's no intention of replacing one lot with the other.
That was Ricardo Suarez de Oliveira talking about his new book, Magnificent and Beggarland, Angola Since the Civil War, to Monocle's Steve Bloomfield in a highlight from Tuesday's Monocle Daily. Up next, we'll take a look at a failed attempt to brand racism. Stay tuned.
The Monocle Weekly is our hard-hitting Sunday show. Our highly disciplined presenters are fearless in pursuit of the big stories. They're not afraid to say exactly what's on their mind.
Going back 400 to 500 years, which is where I'm beginning my research, which is where I believe tailoring was born.
Tights. Come on, it's all going to say tights here.
Asking the big questions.
Before we go any further, do you find sewing sexy?
Sewing.
Tackling the big concepts.
I've always thought of a Yule log as being a chocolate log.
Right.
But in fact, who go to the forest?
Never lost for a word.
It's like a sort of, I don't know how you describe it, like kind of the organ that would be on a Chris Rea B-side.
They're known for their globally-minded approach to news.
Bit of a sort of Russian flavour, does it? Or something, I don't know.
It could be a bit of Commander Burano, or whatever it is.
Yeah. Commander Burano?
Yeah.
Commina
exactly.
Burana.
Exactly, yeah.
They shun the frivolous world of celebrity.
Best of times, worst of times, age of reason, age of folly. You're hot, then you're cold, you yes, then you're no. We fight, we break up, we kiss, we make up.
Who knew that Katy Perry was just like Charles Dickens?
Handling the heavyweight news topics with the reverence they deserve.
And now he's moving around with like the gentleness of a Japanese flower arranger.
So for the most rigorous, probing and occasionally light-hearted look at the week just ended, tune in to the Monocle Weekly each Sunday on Monocle 24.
Things can only go uphill from here, I feel.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted right here on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Now to a rather unusual story, which we turn to on Wednesday's edition of The Briefing. For many of us, the small moment of ordering a morning coffee is a time for casual, friendly banter with your barista. However, if you're an American who happens to like frequenting Starbucks, you might have noticed a rather strange attempt at provoking conversation. Alongside a Twitter hashtag campaign, some Starbucks outlets recently began writing race together on takeaway cups in a rather clumsy effort at tackling racism. The backlash was immediate, with the company's communications senior VP deleting himself from Twitter. Monocle's Tom Edwards was joined by David Michon and Matthew Lowe from Wink Creative right here at Midori House to help us wade through the shark pool of ill-advised corporate causes.
You know, in a lot of cases, a hashtag-based campaign, of which this is one, is a very risky move because, of course, it's not something that you can control very tightly. In fact, you know, the whole point is that it's kind of used really widely by the general public. And, you know, when things go wrong, they go spectacularly wrong. And that's, you know, obviously this Race Together campaign is you know, an example of that. And you know, it's just, you know, that's when it becomes a news story. You know, I can't remember the last time, you know, other than Bring Back Our Girls, you know, which was, you know, criticized for some reasons, but obviously wasn't subjected to this kind of criticism. You know, there's rarely a hashtag campaign that kind of reaches, you know, the mainstream media for positive reasons.
Well, Matthew, let me ask you about that, because I know you've got some views on how big corporations, big companies safeguard these kind of messages, how they get them across in the way they want, how they maintain, I guess, control. And is there a feeling that perhaps that's better for your, you know, corporate responsibility departments to be doing, rather than, as David says, sort of throwing it open to the public and the pitfalls that can become involved there?
Totally. I think even David and I both come from a copywriting background, and the hashtag doesn't really make sense. I asked him when we first were discussing it if they were running. Is it a running club? which is unfortunate, because this is a conversation that needs to be happening, especially in the United States. What is the cafe a forum for it? As David said, and as you set up, Tom, it's really not a place that I want to have that kind of comfortable conversation in. And I don't think, as far as we know, that the staff members are equipped to have these conversations. In an ideal world, they would be equipped with a massive amount of collateral saying what should be said and what shouldn't be said. And I know that's kind of not a very nice thing to think about, but you are communicating the views of a brand. And ultimately, these people's interactions, which also could go viral on Twitter, need to be reflective of the Starbucks Corporation. And so it's much more of a thing for corporate social responsibility, where the employees can buy into Starbucks' stance on racism within the United States and work with it in a more kind of positive manner.
And it's interesting, isn't it, David? I know that there's issues, particularly for Starbucks, when it comes to the role they play more broadly in the US community. There's been suggestions before that because of the way that they tend to filter into communities, that can have a knock-on effect already on what's often a very delicate balance in terms of race relations or the sort of profile in particular parts of the city.
Yeah, of course. I mean, Starbucks is a very frequently highlighted indicator of gentrification, and in a lot of U.S. cities, gentrification has taken has a racial element to it. So it is playing in kind of dangerous waters when Starbucks as a corporation then attempts to style itself as kind of a champion of positive racial. Obviously, those two things, you can't really put them against each other, and the intentions here are really obviously very good ones, but it doesn't really play up to what the brand does well, or it doesn't necessarily highlight the kind of core values of the company. It's adding a value to the company.
I think style itself is a really good way to put it, because I think previously on Branding Corner, another program on Monocle Radio, we talked about Starbucks Reserve, and it feels like Starbucks itself is kind of not really sure what it is as a corporation. I know that the CEO has got himself his foot in a number of other things over the last couple of years. For instance, they were trying to end the freeze in the U.S. Department of Justice, and what are you? You serve coffee.
Wink Creative's David Michon and Matthew Lowe there, speaking with Monocle's Tom Edwards on Wednesday's edition of The Briefing. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24, and it's time now for a highlight from Thursday's edition of Midori House. In this discussion, we headed to the US, where President Barack Obama has been clearly comfortable in the consequence-free, kite-flying stage of his presidency. Speaking in Cleveland, he suggested that maybe it was time that the United States embraced compulsory voting. Though many countries, including Australia, Belgium, and Luxembourg, enforce mandatory suffrage without descending into communist totalitarianism, one suspects this might be a tough sell in Montana and Texas. James Boyce, author of the new book Clinton's Grand Strategy, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, an expert on all things Latin America, joined Monocle's Andrew Muller on Thursday's edition of Midori House.
This is, as you rightly say, Barack Obama just basically flying a kite and spiffballing, talking about things as he enters his lame duckness that he can be attributed to sort of raising because, he's a progressive, etc., etc. But it's risk-free, quite frankly. It won't happen. Would it be a good thing? Well, at the moment, as most people know, if you've got a 60% turnout in a presidential election, that would be seen as a huge number. Even when Obama was running, you know, you're lucky to get figures in the high 50s. So the fact that the largest voting bloc is almost like non-participants is quite remarkable. If those people suddenly showed up to the polls, you could very well have a completely different political dynamic in the country. Obama talked about the idea that the people who are not participating are the youth. Now, that's incredible. The idea that the youth vote between 18 and 24 is the most heavily courted vote within the United States. They have a fortune spent upon them. Those of us of a certain age will no doubt remember the Rock the Vote campaign from the MTV generation. I'm showing my age, I know. But constantly, they're the most courted, and then the least, they talk the most and do the least. And it's actually the silver surfers, the retirees, who are the most likely to go out and vote, and who are voting not for themselves necessarily, but for a future generation. So Obama, of course, has something to gain by this, because the youth vote is more likely to go out and vote for a Democratic left of center administration, arguably, than a Republican. What's the old line? If you're not a liberal in your youth, you have no heart. Yeah. And if you're not a conservative when you get older, you have no brain. So I think there is a political dimension to this. It won't happen. It would be interesting. I know in your own fair country they have compulsory elections, and I think it would be an interesting exercise to see if it was ever implemented.
That was a highlight from Thursday's edition of Midori House. And just before we head off, it's time to look at this week's series from Friday's edition of The Globalist. All this week, we've been taking a look at cultural destruction and what motivates people to pick particular targets. We've discussed devastation by ISIS in Iraq, the 1992 shelling of the National Library in Sarajevo, and the targeting of Timbuktu's manuscripts. On Friday, to close the series, we turned to the problem of looting, of art, artifacts, and antiquities. Rebecca Rushfield is on the board for not-for-profit organisation SAFE, which stands for Saving Antiquities for Everyone. Rebecca spoke to Monocle's Alice Block, who asked what are the world's hotspots for looting and illicit trade in cultural artefacts.
Well, right now, obviously, the Middle East is a hotspot, but there's continuing trafficking going on from all other places, Far East, South America, even in the United States, there are, let's say, Indian grave sites that are looted. It's a worldwide problem.
And looting, you say, supports terrorism. Can you tell me a little bit about how that really works? Say, from the moment when an artifact is stolen from a museum in Iraq or somewhere else, how does that potentially come to support and fund terrorist activity?
Well, it's not even looting from a museum. It's from unauthorized digs. If a terrorist organization or any other non-legal, non-official group, or gets people to dig up or steal artifacts, which then go through the chain of sale and end up in some nice Western museum or private collection, the large sums of money that are involved along the way end up going back to the people or group who authorize the sale. I mean, there's money to be made in the sale of art and artifacts, and even governments and bodies that don't believe in the value of those artworks or artifacts understand that there's money to be made and will make the money.
Well, earlier on in this series on cultural destruction, we spoke to Rebecca Knuth, the author of Burning Books and Leveling Libraries, and she gave us her view on what the so-called international community can do at the moment to stop people from destroying culture. Let's just listen to that for a second.
We've tried thinking in terms of designating sites that are supposed to be sacred, or it's the SHIELD program. But that isn't working because it identifies the sites that are most dear to the world, and that way, you know, in a sense, targets them. These mavericks are operating in a vacuum, and there are really no consequences.
Now, of course, Rebecca Knuth was talking there about cultural destruction specifically, but would you agree that the same is true for those people who are practicing looting of artifacts and archaeology during conflicts and unstable times? I mean, are there no consequences as such for these people? And do you think that's how they think when they act?
There are no consequences because there's a community, there are people out here willing to buy artifacts and works of art without worrying or looking at where they came from. If people were aware that what they buy has blood on it, what they buy is funding terrorism, is funding activities that they perhaps don't agree with, then they might stop buying.
And who are these people? Do we know much about who's buying artifacts that are looted from sites in peacetime or in war? I mean, are they individuals? Are they kind of dodgy dealers as such? I mean, who buys this stuff? Because it must be quite obvious to people, just as when people buy ivory, for example, at some point it must be quite clear that they know what they're doing.
It's individuals primarily. Museums now are much more aware and much more sensitive to the idea that provenance matters, that artifacts are not just beautiful objects to look at, that they have meaning and history and cultural knowledge attached to them. You know, raising public awareness both in the market, the people who would buy the works, and also the people who live in the source countries, who live near these sites that are identified, for them to be aware that what is there is their history, their heritage, their culture. It's important to them. And when, you know, the people who live near the sites take an interest and take an active part in making sure that they're not looted, that changes things too.
And it does seem that the so-called international community is taking the problem of looting and destruction increasingly seriously. Earlier this week, I asked the UNESCO Director General, Irina Bokova, what can be done to punish cultural destruction under existing international law and convention. And this is some of what she had to say.
Yes, I think there are a lot of other things that we could do. The Security Council resolution recently adopted on the 12th of February, 2199, speaks also against the destruction of heritage, against this persecution of minorities and cultural cleansing, but also appeals to us specifically, UNESCO and some other organizations, to look at the matter of the illicit trafficking of objects of archaeology and art as a means of financing of terrorism. So on the other side, we can do a lot more of mobilizing the art markets, the museums, the neighboring countries, police, Interpol, customs authorities, different partners to stop this criminal activity.
That was, of course, UNESCO's Director General speaking to Monocle 24. And Rebecca, her words really bring home the fact that stopping the illegal trade in cultural artefacts is a global project. What barriers are there to this? I mean, if this is a global project, we're talking about objects travelling across borders, how can we coordinate a project against this?
Well, it's hard. There are the international aspects of it, United Nations, the international legal systems that can work to put sanctions on it. There are the national laws. The countries at their borders can try and stop looted objects, illicit trade. And there's the personal aspects. The buyers have to realize that they can't buy these things. But it's even the tourist in Greece who sees some little object for sale in some shop somewhere, who may not realize that this object was taken out of a site and is looted. It's getting everyone to realize that they have to think about, where do things come from?
That was Rebecca Rushfield there, a board member of the organisation SAFE, talking to Monocle's Alice Block. Well, that's all we've got time for in this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and edited by Toby Hammond. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programmes right here on Monocle 24. For now, from me, Ben Ryland, thanks for listening. Goodbye.